I first met Baroness Emma Nicholson just 2 years ago when she was making one of her early first visits to Salt Lake City. We had not been together for more than a few minutes when I realized this was a most remarkable woman, a compassionate and caring human being of the first order, and a very formidable political force of nature. That first meeting laid the groundwork for what has now become a warm and wonderful friendship. It says something that I am excused from a meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve this morning to be here with the Baroness, and I consider that a wonderful tribute from the general officers of the church to her. I do continue to admire her, her tenacity, her moral determination, all that she puts into addressing the tragedies, both personal and public, that we see stemming from conflict in the world, particularly religious conflict, and particularly in the Middle East. It was nearly 25 years ago, long before some in the West were even aware of such abuses, that the Baroness founded AMAR, a humanitarian relief agency she created to address then Saddam Hussein's persecution and extermination of the Marsh Arabs. Since then, that foundation has grown to provide broad aid to and public support for a wide variety of refugees and displaced persons throughout the Middle East region, providing them things ranging from the basics of food and water and clothing and shelter to increasingly sophisticated healthcare services and rehabilitative education. Truly, Emma has and continues to make her personal contribution to the millennial dream of beating swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. Through our own humanitarian aid, and particularly with the cooperation of Sister Sharon Eubank, who heads that operation for us, the church has been able to partner with Baroness Nicholson and AMAR in providing some of these goods and services to the violently traumatized and religiously war-torn region of the Middle East. Emma Nicholson is truly a Renaissance woman. She is vice president of the Man Booker Prize for English Fiction, arguably the most distinguished prize for a work of fiction in the world. She's president of the Kane Prize for African writing, chairman of the Booker Prize for Russian fiction. She holds 7 honorary doctorates and has received many, many awards for her humanitarian work. She served as a member of the House of Commons from 1987 to 1997 and was a confidant to and close political ally of Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. In 1997, she moved to the other chamber of the British Parliament, took her seat as a member of the House of Lords. In that distinguished house, she chairs the Select Committee on Sexual Violence in Conflict and also the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Foreign Affairs. It was this latter inter-party and inter-chamber group that Baroness Nicholson invited me to speak in England last June. For a former British missionary to be invited to address members of Parliament in the palace at Westminster was a very personal privilege indeed. It beat knocking on doors. Baroness Nicholson, I give you, the Brigham Young University student and faculty audience, I am confident you will never address a more respectful nor more responsive university gathering anywhere in the world. Students and faculty, I give you my friend, Emma Nicholson, Baroness of Winterbourne and humanitarian par excellence. She has embraced wholeheartedly the Savior's teaching that if we have done it unto the least of those among us, we have done it unto Him. Baroness Nicholson.
Thank you, Elder Holland, most warmly, for your kind welcome and for your typically generous introduction. I was delighted and happy to welcome you to my own place of work, the British Parliament's upper house, the House of Lords, in June of this year. And there, in the mother of parliaments, you gave a truly memorable speech to the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Foreign Affairs. Members of both houses, members of Parliament and peers, listened intently. And your speech was watched and listened to by the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, Dr. Rosh Sharwaiz, who visited us especially to hear you. Your speech, which resonated throughout the audience and which we published immediately, continues to be discussed and your points raised by many who were not present on that day. Please come again soon. We welcomed, and indeed we need, your thinking. It's your duty to come. May I thank next President Worthen for his very, very kind hospitality, and Mrs. Worthen, on this momentous occasion. Thank you very much indeed for your hospitality and for inviting me to address your students and with them their tutors and professors. The range of knowledge that this audience must hold reflects the BYU deep commitment to hard work, clean living, and clear focus on a good future under your presidency. And this is your personal and very high achievement for which all of us here today and those listening elsewhere thank you. Education is the key to a better world. Thank you also to your predecessor, President Samuelson, for the kind loan of Paul Kerry, whose intellectual and personal support for the Amar Foundation, which I chair, is of huge value to us. He has also generously given personal time to support my own political work, all-party parliamentary groups, and my other committee responsibilities, for which I heartily thank him. I thank BYU now for the introduction to Emily Stevens, a great addition to the Amar family. Her commitment, her great enthusiasm, make her a tremendous asset for our work. And just now, Amar's all-Iraqi medical team cares for 1 million patients, and our all-Iraqi teachers have over 180,000 pupils of all ages. And all of this work is carried out vocationally and at a fraction of normal cost. Now, this approach, by wonderful coincidence, mirrors exactly the approach of LDS charities. It is no coincidence that 18 months ago, I signed a powerful friendship and cooperation agreement entitled a Memorandum of Understanding between LDS charities and the Amar Foundation. And the document was created by the head of LDS charities, Sharon Eubank, and the chief executive of the Amar Foundation, Richard Crowe. So, how did this friendship come about? For this, we have to thank Jim Olson, now a board member of Amar in Washington, co-chair of the Amar Utah Supporters Circle, alongside Charlene Hawkes. Thank you, Jim. We owe to you and you alone the amazing grace of this powerful friendship between us all, which is benefiting daily thousands of men and women and children in greatest possible need. Jim's beloved parents, married now for 70 years on Sunday last September 15, are with us here today. Welcome and congratulations to Calvin and Ruth. Now, I thank all of you, my new friends, making up our audience here today. Thank you for giving your precious time and serious attention to our meeting here. BYU places a big burden on you, its students. One of intensive work, coupled with sport, art, music, continued commitment to the practice of a life of high virtue and shared ethics, and in addition, as we are all tasked as fellow human beings, you have the obligation to help those in need. And that's not an easy program to fulfill. The pressure to succeed in all of those fields, particularly in finding time and energy to help the neediest, must sometimes feel a real burden on you. You may even wonder if you can manage it. And looking at the poverty of millions of people, I often feel the same. What means our personal success when others are forced to survive in such terrible circumstances? My own starting point is simply this. In any situation or field of human action, success is rated by how you manage within the circumstances that you find yourselves. And if these circumstances are unprepossessing, success is ranked by your ability to change them. I brought that young lady to London recently. Her great success was to remain alive when man after man, aggressive, cruel, and filled with determined hatred for her faith, raped her in terrible surroundings while her sister on one occasion was being raped nearby. She is a young Yazidi victim of ISIL, the terrorists who have invaded Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, and Yemen, and who are now successfully infiltrating our Western nations. They hate our freedoms, particularly our freedom to worship. They cannot grasp, they therefore oppose, our free trade and capitalism, our separation of powers. They fear our creativity, our art, our music, and they are ready to kill us and die themselves to achieve the destruction of the values and civilizations that we hold so dear. My sweet natured and gentle Yazidi girl, all of 16 years old, succeeded against all odds. Her success? First to survive through months of rape by countless males. One dreadful night, six of them, high on cocaine and violent pornographic videos, raped her all night long. And after some months of this treatment, with supreme courage, she dared to flee into the dark night of unknown terrors, and thereby saved her life. Now the ISIL tormentors padlock their Yazidi girls into cages at night, so that escape is physically beyond them. Like this beautiful, sad, and dignified young woman, I too came from a loving and stable family. I grew up after the Second World War, when allies Britain and the USA were winning partners. The horrors of anti-Semitism and the destruction of so many families through combat or the concentration camps shaped my childhood and grew in me a burning desire to help rebuild our nation and to assist in the rebuilding of our neighbours across the Channel. France and Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, the Nordic countries, all had been shattered. And the task of nation rebuilding, with all that that entails, was very clear. Corruption was rife, war and an unstable situation brings out the criminals with their exceptional talent in illegal trading. Orphans needed care, both parents lost or killed, widows aplenty with the deep poverty widowhood almost always brings, and the physical demolition through bombing was all around. Whenever I looked in London and in towns and villages, I saw bomb sites and shattered buildings. My own family was exceptionally political. At that time, neither members of parliament nor peers received salaries or expenses, so all worked too to keep their families. My father's lengthy working hours were dedicated to business and politics. He was in the House of Commons, and to the constituency, a third and constant focus. My father was not the only family member of parliament. There were at least 13 of them in the Commons at that time, with others trying to get elected. and many more family members sat in the House of Lords. And many of our visitors and some neighbours were politicians too. I drank in their discussions. Naturally, for that time, all of them were male. As a child and growing up, I supported Papa, uncles, and cousins as they ran for office. They were my family. Whatever their views, I campaigned mightily for each and every one. It seemed to me that being in Parliament was the best way of achieving the major social, economic, and other changes that our country needed badly. And we four sisters, we were proud that one grandfather and three great-grandfathers were in Parliament, the fourth a rural dean, and that stretching back on all sides, generation after generation, gave public service in Parliament while raising large families, farming, serving in the military, and managing businesses. I did have one determinedly campaigning grandmother, however. She was a suffragiste, that's a non-violent suffragette, and of Huguenot descent. Her family fled France after the 1572 massacre of St. Bartholomew's, that centuries earlier precursor of Kristallnacht. We found a lovely picture of her in my father's papers. She stood very boldly, clad in demurest black with gloves and a hat with a veil, standing defiantly beside a huge and disapproving London policeman. She was holding up a vast banner which read, "Votes for Women." So it wasn't that the women of my family were not interested in politics, they surely were, but the opportunity to serve directly was wholly denied to them, as it was to all other women of their time. I decided early to enter politics. Supporting my male relations was insufficient, particularly at times when I did not agree with some of the policies they stood for. Winston Churchill was the great political figure throughout my childhood. His defeat post-war resounded subsequently for many years. It taught me the essential transience of political achievement. He was a true hero, yet like Ulysses, he was defeated after his greatest win. My father, a young member of Parliament, had been his very first pre-war supporter to become Britain's war leader. Yet soon after the war began, Churchill dispatched my father's elder and only brother to defend the French port of Calais, on which the German forces were fast advancing. But in his haste, Churchill dispatched Uncle Claude's brigade without sufficient equipment and supplies. They fought to the death, and Calais fell. Ever afterwards, Churchill mournfully recalled his error, blaming himself to my father for Uncle Claude's death. For as Prime Minister, he had sent a message through Anthony Eden, a later Prime Minister, to tell Claude Nicholson not to surrender, to fight to the death, to protect the retreat from Dunkirk beaches of the remainder of the British Army, and not to tell his officers or men. I recall well as a small child running into the House of Commons smoking room to find my father and another member of Parliament nurturing the vast and almost immobile Winston Churchill, seated in a wing-hung chair, armchair, and puffing on a very fat and stubby cigar. His funeral procession that I saw from the Treasury ringside seat was in pouring rain and cold. His coffin, drawn slowly around his beloved Parliament Square, where there is now a famous bronze statue of him, looking at the Houses of Parliament that he saved. I left home and went off to boarding school at the age of 7, and on to board at the second one at age 11. We had much music. I led the choir and played the organ in church and in school chapel, a great experience that I loved. My alma mater is the Royal Academy of Music. My aim was to become a concert pianist at that place of global fame, as well as, if I were very lucky later on, a politician. But music, despite a childhood of practicing at the required topmost professional level, eluded me. My lack of sufficient hearing has been a big gap in my life since birth. So after fully qualifying, I stepped aside from music as a regular career, but used that rigorous training in a much newer field. I changed course entirely and tried for an impossible goal to enter the brand new world of information technology. I have to say that I knew nothing of it. I didn't even understand the word computer. At that time, it was a purely scientific discipline, but it sounded intriguing. I sneaked into a high-level computer examination and against all odds gained a rare and highly prized position to train in computer software engineering. I subsequently spent a fascinating decade with brilliant colleagues, all mathematicians, none like myself a musician, teaching, team leading, and inventing arcane information retrieval techniques and other intellectually satisfying software developments in the UK and sub-Saharan Africa. And I followed that up with a highly satisfying spell of work combating childhood poverty internationally as a director of Save the Children. I was first directed to the charity as a client since their primitive IT system had collapsed, and in my then field of work, we all wished to save all children. These highly varied work challenges were extraordinarily interesting, and I valued the many chances that arose if you looked hard enough to use business and charitable interventions to enhance the common good. But it wasn't enough for me, for I believe profoundly that our lives must be committed wholly to embracing the values that the common good enshrines. Societies in fragile states too often lack the vitally important pillars of a free society: democracy, the freedom for each individual to worship, work, own goods and property, for all citizens to be free from hunger, poverty, and distress, and to be able to raise families in peace and prosperity within the safety of the rule of law. And they seek our help to gain these fundamental pillars. I continued to seek a way into politics. I sought advice. Other senior and important women who tried and failed to enter Parliament strongly warned me off. My gender was against me. Politics is a relentless fight to the death, and all of the advice was negative. Don't waste your time, I was told. The party will never really accept female MPs. And there was nothing for it. I had to stop asking and have a go. So I took a deep breath and plunged into the snake pit that was and always will be politics, planning to fight successfully and be elected, while knowing that I might easily be destroyed politically and disappear from view. The party application form was my first step to becoming a potential parliamentary candidate. It asked me two vitally important questions. The first, what was my wife's maiden name? I puzzled over that for quite some minutes. Marriage seemed to be a requirement. There was no answer space available for a single person. And the candidate was obviously expected to be a male. Difficult to reply. Frankly, impossible. But I had to write something or risk immediate dismissal. But the worst question was over the page. Did I agree with all the party's policies? And the space left to answer was no bigger than my little fingernail. There was absolutely no room, no luxury of debate. So I took a deep breath. I reminded myself to research these policies if I got out, and wrote firmly, yes. So I became a potential Conservative candidate for the next general election. The constituency party selection battle came next. If you went to an interview as a female but wearing smart clothes, you were informed you were overdressed. The other way round, the rejection came because you were insufficiently smart. Wearing high-heeled shoes was a no-no, but so was wearing flats. Married, the voter would clearly prefer you to look after your family at home. Unmarried, the voters would obviously prefer married candidates. From a well-known family, you were $2,000. From an unknown family, a modest personal background, that was not good enough. And frequently these contraindicative comments were made at the same meeting to each one of the few female candidates. Occasionally, waiting for my turn, I mopped up the tears of a fellow would-be candidate female whose coping powers failed under these personal onslaughts. Even worse, the fearsome chairman who posed these questions were often women themselves. And once, after a particularly nasty round of questions to several female candidates who retired in misery, I answered back for all of us. Instead of playing possum, and the interview panel collapsed, my barbed answer to Madam Chair had been spot on. I was dismissed immediately by her, but the senior official, a man, followed me out to thank me on behalf of the committee. The lady had been a real bully for too long. They were very sad not to see me again. I'd done their work for them in fighting back. But naturally, I didn't get selected there. I redoubled my efforts, resulting in my gaining the highest number of final interviews without being selected in the history of my chosen political party. My charitable work alone was simply not enough to meet our nation's problems. Political decisions framed society, and better political decisions, I felt, would conquer poverty more quickly and more effectively. The building blocks of any society, as I saw it, demanded determined political action which would embed the fundamental freedoms into law, and that in turn would enable self-sufficiency to flourish in Britain and elsewhere. To participate fully in creating the changes that I sought so strongly, I needed to become an MP. I was at last selected for a northern, heavily socialist constituency that was, in political terminology, a hopeless seat that you could never win but where you earned your spurs. I spent 3 years of private time and all of my salary in an area of coal mine closures, failed businesses, and fruitless government intervention spending designed to curb the massive unemployment that a major industrial collapse leaves behind. I did not win the ensuing election, although I gained many thousands more votes than any previous candidate had ever done. But a new National Party leader had earlier emerged, and as a candidate, I got to see her. Yes, she was a woman, and a very remarkable woman at that, called Margaret Thatcher. I admired and liked her immensely, immediately. And indeed, it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to get her in as our leader. She offered a direct approach and a very clear vision at a time when Britain was plagued with strikes and economic collapse. I liked her style very much indeed. And 3 years on, I received a call out of the blue that seemed like a miracle. The party gave me an offer I couldn't refuse. I was invited to become party vice president. I worked with Mrs. Thatcher in that voluntary position for a truly fascinating and highly challenging 4 years. Communism started to exhibit major signs of decay. We worked hard to collapse that harsh and useless system and to destroy its rotting siblings. We won national and local elections hand over fist, and the party's popularity grew. The IRA then struck on the mainland for the first ever time. Mrs. Thatcher, her senior ministers, and the 5 of us who led the party were blown up in the night by a massive bomb in Brighton, a calm seaside town where we were holding our annual conference. When the dawn came, the hotel was virtually destroyed, and the horizon was blotted out by a Steel Bay Royal Navy warship. There were marksmen on every rooftop. Several of us, the party leaders, gathered together with our officials at 4 a.m. at the nearby street corner. We decided at once to continue the party conference. We couldn't allow the terrorists to stop us. Dressed in our nightwear, the first call at 6 a.m. was to Marks and Spencer's. We roused the manager and bought suitable black clothes. Then by 9 o'clock, we were on the stage of the conference hall, business as usual. And the gaps in our lineup told us then exactly who had been killed. I was elected subsequently as a member of three different parliaments four times. I served for a decade in the House of Commons. Next came a further elected decade after my husband's untimely death in the European Parliament. I was and still remain a member of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And along the way, I was honoured and appointed by Her Majesty the Queen to the peerage. My first successful for a winnable constituency was in the beautiful county of Devon. I left my job, married, and moved there. My constituency's core activity was farming. Indeed, the local news asked the farmers why I had been chosen. There were three favoured male candidates, and I was the make-weight to give the inclusion of the woman, yet I had won. And the old farmer replied that it was like choosing a prize cow. You looked at her head, you saw the way she walked, and you made your choice. For the farmers, I was best of breed. We got on very well, and I fought hard and successfully for my constituency's many causes, although the House of Commons nearly broke up my marriage at the start. My husband blenched at breakfast when he received a letter warmly inviting him to become a member of the Parliamentary Christian Wives. I thought I'd lost him. It was a great decade and much was achieved. My battles for dairy and sheep farmers and their families was matched by far distant battles that I joined in the Middle East and Romania. For in 1991, two terrible human crises pushed up from their depths of hell and came into view. The orphans of Ceausescu's Romania and the Iraq chemical weapons and torture victims of Saddam Hussein. Nightmares, both. I couldn't ignore the suffering. My first trip to Romania was organized by the Parliamentary Friends of Israel. They invited me to balance their delegation. I said, how? The reply came that I was both a Gentile and a woman, so very useful in public relations terms. I went to visit the largest orphanage in Bucharest. It was a horror story. I started the Associata Children's High Level Group charity to help. We put in a sewage plant, lavatories, clean water, brought health and food supplies. There were 650 mentally handicapped boys from 3 to 26 years of age, reeking with filth, with only flimsy striped torn cotton pajamas to wear, and they were barely alive. One meal a day of thin soup. They were starving to death and locked in by barbed wire fences. A month before, having listened from Iraqi refugees to the stories of Saddam's monstrosities against humanity, I slipped into Iraq by the back door in a low-slung paddle boat. A local fisherman, whose sense of direction was acute, took me across the southern Mesopotamian marshlands, where I saw firsthand that the brutality and cruelty of Saddam's henchmen was well beyond the knowledge of the Western world. I determined to speak up in the House of Commons and outside, and I returned again to Iraq almost immediately to do so. Certainly crossing the water borders that separate southern Iran and Iraq was a less than courteous way of entering a foreign country, but it was justified since Saddam was using chemical weapons and probably committing genocide. Nor could I assist his victims with food and clothing unless I exercised responsible transparency and accountability in situ. But after each covert mission into the marshes, I issued a press statement decrying Saddam's genocidal war against the people and calling attention to his use of chemical weapons, of which I painstakingly collected proof. My name rapidly became one of the few that Saddam knew, and I was regularly blasted by him through the compliant Iraq media. I refused his several formal invitations sent to me by the Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament to visit officially, if only because I could never step on the face of the US President, George Bush Sr., which Saddam had thoughtfully had mosaicked onto the entrance to the official hotel where no foreign visitor could avoid disgracing the Bush image. Across the borders in neighboring Iran, another really difficult country to work in, the sufferings of the Iraqi refugees were acute and unresolved. I started the Amar Foundation once I realized that the problem was not going to go away. And my purpose was to help the thousands upon thousands of people, men, women, and children, streaming out of Iraq, some dying and all desperate, to rebuild lives dominated by genocide and discrimination was my purpose. I found brilliant and despairing medical and teaching professionals within the Iran-based Iraqi refugee camps, and together we pushed the boundaries of our aid inside Iraq itself. And throughout the 90s and early 2000s, I continued to provide the crucial charitable funding and lead the operation as best I could. The team I built up successfully sourced and delivered hundreds of tons of food, clothing, medicines, and provided family health and proper schooling for upwards of 250,000 Iraqi refugees. And with even more difficulty, I moved aid for many thousands of Iraq's internally displaced, wrecked families across the border and into the country itself. This further aroused Saddam's fury, and I was delighted. After my husband's unexpected death, I moved away from the Devon constituency that had framed our happiness. I threw caution to the winds and put myself forward for a new and untried constituency of 10 million people in the far wealthier southeast region of England. My sisters and close family were delighted until they found I would be travelling even more than before, all over everywhere, it seemed. In the European Parliament for an intensive decade, I worked on foreign policy, common defence and security policy, and human rights. I was elected vice president of the largest, most senior and interesting committee that dealt with all of those subjects. And with my special knowledge, I wrote parliamentary reports that effected change for the better in Europe's policies on a number of countries and on key issues. And the secret lay, as it always does, in partnership and in cooperation, this time with the different member nations and their many political parties. It was a challenging but rewarding time. Early on, I was appointed by my committee to take on Romania. Now was my chance to tackle the nation's open wound of the so-called orphan children. In fact, they all had families, which the state was deliberately destroying for financial gain. Many thousands of these sad Romanian children suffered shocking abuse, and many more were trafficked for profit. 30,000 innocent anonymous children sent to unknown or unfit destinations over a 10-year period alone. No one knew where or to whom they had been dispatched. I could not even trace their names on the relevant government departmental computers. The government, the Romanian government's 1954 family law, was, unknown by the outside world, still in place. It underlay all subsequent legislation on children that the EU and other democracies had suggested and that had been voted into law. This communist and brutally effective piece of ancient but deliberately surviving legislation gave away full parental rights on any live birth to the state on demand with no parental redress. There lay the problem, lurking like a deadly reptile beneath the surface. It had to go. After 4 years of intensive work and much political persuasion, we in the European community achieved a fully modern Children's Act, which correctly followed the UN conventions to keep the child protected within its family. Money, the root of this evil, lay at the heart of this squalid, state-led child abuse and of family destruction on an industrial scale. And just 10 years after this law was passed, Romania's outcast children have flourished and society's attitudes have changed towards them. Not far away in Russia, human trafficking was still legal. I had the good fortune of a chance meeting at a distant minor airport with 5 hours to wait and nothing to do. In the same VVIP dismal waiting room was the Speaker of the Russian Duma. I found some bottles of vodka for him, not me, and introduced myself. And after our in-depth discussion a year later and some empty bottles, he successfully steered anti-trafficking legislation into Russian law. Nothing can happen long-term without good law to get it implemented. I worked continually in the European Parliament on Iraq, and on one slightly startling occasion, as I waited to address Parliament, the debate became very intense on allowing former Ba'ath Party jobs and pensions. MPs suddenly almost all walked out. The Speaker had lost his quorum, and with it he lost his cool. Unexpectedly, his eye fell on me, awaiting my scheduled time to address the Parliament. To my horror, he shouted that I, as a visitor, had votes, and that he had thereby recovered his quorum. The highly controversial legislation was passed, while I, protestations ignored, was the unwilling and illegal facilitator. I made my speech to a packed and happy chamber. And inside and outside of the Green Zone, I worked with a succession of remarkably gifted US generals, Odierno, Hammond, and Chiarelli, in order to help the AMAR model of health and welfare become a reality inside Iraq. And with their wonderful help, the AMAR team built, equipped, and staffed 45 health clinics serving thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians throughout all parts of Baghdad and the south. It was therefore a tremendous honor for me to address the Utah National Guard at their headquarters in Draper yesterday. I also became an expert in monitoring and observing elections, and I also became an expert in detecting electoral corruption. There are so many ways of cheating the electorate. Around the globe, everyone wants the chance to choose and change their leader, yet government after government makes it their business to deceive the voter, and while supporting elections, to actually cheat the voter. Now I'm back in London, and most joyfully, I serve as a peer of the realm, and I sit in the upper house. I am opposing the self-named Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. I visited their front line earlier this year and saw from their fragile headquarters in KRG how near we were to the KRG border. And as I talked to Christian families staggered across, having walked over 100 miles to escape, their lives as farmers gone in an instant, and they have now joined 3.1 million internally displaced people condemned to live their lives as refugees. The partnership of LDS charities with AMAR is enabling the swift building of a health centre to support them and people like them. This year, the year of the celebration of the Magna Carta, I want to remind you that the law is the bulwark against the collapse of settled societies. We all join in celebrating the Magna Carta. Written in 1215 AD and signed and sealed by the king, nobles, and bishops, it enshrines in law the fundamental rights of the freemen against their removal by the king himself. The American Declaration of Independence and the US Constitution builds on that famous charter. I joined in gracing the celebration of this with Prince Charles earlier this year in Washington, a great occasion. In Britain, our beloved Queen opened the latest session of the Houses of Parliament just a few years ago in London. And her 63 years of service offer the benchmarks that all of us can freely follow and through which we can all succeed. I give this to you as my statement of today. She said, "When life seems hard, the courageous do not accept defeat. Instead, they are all the more determined to struggle for a better future." I wish you well. I look forward to your achievements. I will cherish our continuing friendship, and I thank you for your courtesy and for your commitment to all things true and good, today, tomorrow, and forever. Thank you.